Okay, hi. So this is called formulaic. Some of this material in the first half of this paper will be familiar to people, and I'm going to apologise in advance because I just wasn't sure how many people would know this stuff or not. I've assumed no familiarity. So I'm sorry if you find, you know, part of it initially a little old hat, but I promise I'll try and say something rash towards the end. Okay, formulaic. This paper concerns the transmission of culture, with particular focus on how that phenomenon occurs in societies without writing. It will, at least initially, give the picture of a quite conservative poetics. I start with a picture of a poet, and I'll read out that caption down the bottom. Avdom Medvedevich, peasant farmer, is the finest singer the expedition encountered. His poems reached as many as 15,000 lines, a veritable Yugoslav Homer. There are a few things of interest here. Note firstly the reference to an expedition. The one in question involved three fieldwork trips. The first two of these trips were led by Milman Parry, assistant professor in classics at Harvard, and these trips involved time in the Bosniak parts of the former Yugoslavia, over 1933 and then again over 1934-5. Parry's aim was to observe and record illiterate men like Avdo, pictured here, singing oral epic poems. Parry was accompanied by Albert Bates Lord on the second of these trips. Then his research assistant, Lord, went on to succeed Parry, who died suddenly in 1935, conducting further field work in the former Yugoslavia and Albania for the third of the trips, which took place over 1950 to 1951. In 1960, Lord published the first monograph to emerge from the expedition, The Singer of Tales. That extraordinary book remains, as Gregory Nagy put it recently, quote, the definitive book on the subject of oral poetry. Note secondly how this caption, on, by the way, we're looking at an image from Lord's photo album, and it's his caption as well. Note secondly how this caption describes Avdo Medvedevich as the finest of the oral poets the expedition encountered. It's worth saying something about the aesthetics behind such a judgment. To label Avdo the finest had nothing to do with him transcending the tradition in which he sung, along the lines of, say, Randall Jarrell's assertion that the good in poetry is always a white blackbird, an abnormal and unlikely excellence. The point for a poet like Avdo was to be the black blackbird. In Lord's words, the South Slav poet has, quote, the role of the conserver of the tradition, the role of the defender of the historic truth of what is being sung. For if the singer changes what he has heard, in essence, he falsifies truth. Such a poet does not shrink from the habitual, nor does he seek the unusual for its own sake. Incidentally, that image has nothing to do with this paper. To the contrary, the poet's aim is to reproduce the same song others have sung before him, drawing on the same phrasing, depicting the same typical scenes, within the same overall narrative arcs. That poet really is trying to create the exemplary poem, not just in the superlative sense of the word exemplary, but in its normative acceptation as well. Here is how Parry explained things in a 1930 article. The oral poet by no means limits his borrowing to the single formula. Rather, he uses whole passages which he has heard. This is indeed his whole art, to make a poem like the poems he has heard. I know only too well that this is sure to suggest the thought of plagiarism to those not familiar with oral poetry, but it must be understood above all that plagiarism is not possible in traditional literature. Parry's comment underlines that in this aesthetic culture, the finest poet is the one who can, quoting from here, make a poem like the poems he has heard. But to show how such a poem might be created, let me direct you to Parry's reference at the top of this quote to the formula, a technical term in his and Lord's work. In Parry's famous definition, a formula is, quote, a group of words which is regularly employed under the same metrical conditions to express a given essential idea. It may help to think of this in Homeric terms. Call to mind heroic epithets like much-suffering godlike Odysseus or swift-footed Achilles, or formulaic phrases like the wine-dark sea, to the swift ships of the Achaeans, or when rosy-fingered dawn, child of morning, arose. What Parry and Lord heard from the singers in the old Yugoslavia were formula-packed lines like this one. This is just one line plucked from a poem of over 1,000 lines. Yala reči za sedi dogata, translated, with by Allah she mounted her horse. So this is line 789 of Salih Uglyanin's Song of Baghdad. Now, Lord did a statistical analysis of lines 789 to 804 from Uglyanin's 1934 performance of the Song of Baghdad, and he compared them against 12,000 other lines recorded and transcribed from that same poet. On this basis, Lord could show that one quarter of the whole lines in the sample and one half of the half lines are formulas. That is, metrically apt phrases repeated again and again at just that position in the line. So you would get the whole line would be repeated, right? As they say, one quarter of the whole lines in this sample of 15 are repeated in toto throughout the rest of this poet's works. You get exactly that, Yala Reci Zasedi Dogata. And then half of the half lines. So Yala Reci will constantly appear. There's a compulsory caesura in this decasyllabic line. So Yala Reci takes up the first four syllables, and then you get something else on the other side of the caesura. Alternately, you get something else at the start, and usually that'll be formulaic as well. And then you'll get Zasedi Dogata and variants of that as well. The formulas are, in Lord's words, quote, in reality, all pervasive. There is nothing in the poem that is not formulaic. A similarly extreme formulaicity could be detected in the diction of all the poets, including that of Avdo Midyedovich himself, the finest of them all. At which point you might ask, well, where is the art in all this? Here we come to something quite extraordinary. One of the ways the art comes is in the fact that these poems are being made up on the spot. Successive recordings of the same singer showed beyond a doubt that this was the case. Each poem emerged differently at each of multiple iterations. Lord summarises Parry's finding this way, quote, singer, performer, composer and poet are one. Singing, performing, composing are facets of the same act. For, quote, in a very real sense, every performance is a separate song. The revolution this insight affected in fields like folklorics, classics and media studies has been massive, though it is still yet to have all that much effect on popular conceptions of traditional cultural transmission. In relation to those popular conceptions, consider Lord's reference in 1960 to the, quote, present vogue of revival of folk singing on the concert stage. That revival actually, Lord suggests, gives a totally incorrect picture of traditional oral poetry. Quoting Lord, an oral poem is not composed for, but in performance. Similarly illusory, Lord claimed, were ideas about the, quote, fantastic memories so well attested of illiterate people. The memories that purportedly serve to ensure cultural continuity without writing. In fact, that cultural continuity is ensured by those same illiterate people repeatedly making their literary heritage up again on the spot. Parry, and then Lord following him, rationalised the oral poet's recourse to formulas on these same improvisational grounds. The formulas, according to them, were what made rapid composing in performance possible. At this point, I should add, if it is not already apparent, that Lord believed that what he and Parry observed among the South Slav poets applied to the composition of non-literate poetries everywhere. In cultures without writing, quoting Lord, each performance is more than a performance. It is a recreation on the spot via these formulaic elements. I hasten to add that this tenet of oral formulaic theory has by and large been demonstrated. True, Ruth Finnegan has tabled numerous practices of verbatim recital in cultures without writing, particularly in the matter of short lyric. And other ethnographers have found combinations of verbatim recital and oral formulaic improvisation, as in Dwight Reynolds' work on the singers of North Egyptian epic. But the characterisation by and large holds. By the 1980s, John Miles Foley summarises, Parry and Lord's ideas, quote, would affect more than 100 language areas as disparate as Chinese, African, Australian, and Native American. As for the Lord's reference to Avdo Medijedovic as, quote, our Yugoslav Homer, in that caption I put up before, there is strong, if not total consent among Homerists, that the Homeric poems were composed in an oral formulaic manner as well. I.e., whoops, you don't want to miss that guy's stare. He's great. The Homeric poems were composed in an oral formulaic manner as well, i.e., handed down by numerous lineages of unlettered men, each time making the stories of Podas Orcus Achilleus, swift-footed Achilles, and Polutlas Dios Odysseus, much-suffering godlike Odysseus, making those stories up again on the spot. More recent strands of oral formulaic theory take the matter even further. For is not speaking itself a repeated performative act of making one's culture up again on the spot? Can one help it? Part two. In fact, there are a number of ways we might use Parian Lord's work on oral formulaic composition to cast light on the practices of contemporary literate cultures. Over the remainder of this paper, I want to focus on how Parian Lord's work relativizes our sense of what it is for us to say that one poem, X, is like another poem, Y. The relevance of this to the question of exemplarity is, I imagine, apparent. For a poem can only be exemplary of a group of poems insofar as it is like them, whether superlatively or normatively so. But how is likeness determined? The Parry Lord materials indicate that the matter is not as straightforward as we might imagine. I mentioned at the start of this paper that Parry was assistant professor in classics. Above all else, his and Lord's South Slav fieldwork was driven by the desire to establish comparative data on how the Homeric poems might have been handed down in times without writing. They wanted, that is to say, to solve the famous Homer question. For that reason, the two found themselves particularly intrigued by the Slavic poet's claims to be able to reproduce other singers' poems, and not just to reproduce them, but to do so on a single hearing. When Parry and Lord tested this, the results were quite remarkable. A singer like Avdo Medijedovic could indeed reproduce the same 2,294-line poem he had just heard Mumen Vlahovljak sing straight after hearing it. He could reproduce this, you know, 2,300-line poem. What was remarkable was not merely the cognitive act this involved, bolstered by the very formulaic features I've been describing. What was remarkable was not so much that, as that for Avdo, reproducing one and the same song included taking the license to add ornament and detail, to change the order in which the dramatis personae appear, to shift the placement of the themes, and most extraordinarily of all, to triple the number of lines, from 2,294 to 6,313. Yet for all these changes, Avdo still regarded the poem he had created to be the very same poem he had heard. Similar results obtained when Parry and Lord recorded Dima Zorgic repeating one of Suleiman Markic's poems an hour after hearing it, right, so just on one hearing. And there were numerous, numerous changes. Yet Dimo himself stressed that he had repeated the poem, quote, word for word and line for line. For him, it was exactly the same poem. Now, in fact, what these claims for verbatim identity really amounted to was a sameness at the level of plot. And I don't mean by that the way it was narrated or even the order of events in the narration, but just at the level of the simple story itself. That's what they're seeing as the same poem. That's not connected with this talk either. Hence the irony of Lord's resonant claim that the singer is, quote, not a mere carrier of the tradition, but a creative artist making the tradition. For though Avdo, in improvisatedly tripling the length of the poem he had just heard, adding ornament and detail and so forth, though he was clearly acting, in our terms, as a creative artist, it is also clear that to him, this improvisatory practice was far less original than it seems to us. Lord underlines this point. Quoting Lord, "The changes of which we've been speaking have been brought about not by forces seeking change for its own sake, nor by pure chance, but by an insistent conservative urge for preservation of an essential idea." Wittgenstein wrote that the idea of exact was ultimately ethical. In the course of his ferocious demolition of the alibi mathematical reasoning provides for knowledge in the modern era. There is something of that power here, in Lord's quiet demonstration that a given culture's canons of likeness are just as socio-historically given as any other category, and could well appear exorbitant to future or foreign eyes. Our very attempts to be conservative toward the past might have just this upshot. Actually, Lord's analysis of what counts as the same song among the South Slav poets reminds me of some of the operations of identity in scholarship as well. I have in mind the way we in the humanities smuggle all sorts of novel ideas into our respective fields under the guise of repetition. Consider the blithe way we use phrases like Foucault argues, Lacan says, in Bakhtin's theory, as if any of these enigmatic thinkers really could be captured in paraphrase. To repeat their ideas is often as not to create them anew, on the conveniently legitimate grounds that one is simply repeating. In fact, the more one ponders Lord's discussion of the oral poet's understanding of verbatim repetition, the more unsettling it becomes. Maximally, one might suggest that this is how a culture reproduces itself in general, through the constant recreation of what it thinks is the same. Have I got a couple more minutes, Meredith?
You've got 60 minutes.
Oh, fantastic. Great. I'll have a drink too. I wanted to point to this relativization of the idea of the same poem from the Parry Lord corpus, because it puts any scholarly attempt to determine what is exemplary of a given culture's poetry under a certain pressure. After all, whether you take the phrase the exemplary poem in either its normative or superlative meanings, it's clear that any determination of exemplarity will involve drawing on preconceived ideas as to sameness and difference. Consider my earlier quotation from Jarrell, his reference to the idea that the good in poetry is always a white blackbird, an abnormal and unlikely excellence. Reflecting on this, we would probably have to say that the superlative poem for Jarrell is characterised by its recognisable unlikeness to all other members of the category in which it nonetheless finds itself. But surely, Parry and Lord's work leads me to suggest, our ability to recognise unlikeness is just as culturally given as our ability to recognise likeness. The poems of the singers Parry and Lord studied seem markedly different to us, for all their apparent sameness to the singers. Conversely, from another culture's perspective, the seeming unlikeness and idiosyncrasy characterising the works of poets as diverse and sui generis as C.D. Wright, Maeve Magukian, Jan Owen and Don Patterson, that sense of unlikeness about their productions may well dissipate from another perspective. It may even seem somewhat formulaically achieved. Please don't get me wrong here. These are poets I love, whose work I revel in. And in fact, I read their work much more than I read ethnographic transcripts of the epic productions of unlettered farmers from the former Yugoslavia. This is my preferred bedside reading, these guys. I revel in the difference poets like Wright or Magukian force me to confront. But I'm pleasantly estranged by the fact that in his analysis of the formulaic properties of the South Slavic poets, Lord allows for something like the guaranteeing particularity which Randall Jarrell champions, through the above quote and elsewhere, one of Jarrell's phrases, a guaranteeing particularity. He's referring to Whitman, to Dickinson, to Bishop, various others. The oral poet's traditional style, Lord writes early on in The Singer of Tales, quote, also has individuality, and it is possible to distinguish the songs of one singer from those of another, even when we have only the bare text, without music and vocal nuance. After all, each poet uses formulas in his own way. What is more, each singer's formulaic usage becomes more individuated as they get older. Lord goes as far as to claim that difference in formula use constitutes, quoting him, a clear and statistically measurable mark of a difference between the two men, between two singers. It is a striking and counterintuitive claim of the sort one comes to expect, inasmuch as such a thing can be expected, from Lord's writing. According to him, individuality itself arises from the deployment of formulas. It's a matter of formulaicity. But how one might think a formulaic aspect to contemporary poetry? How might one do so without simply and brutally reducing its wild pursuit of difference in the manner of, say, Khrushchev's claim that all modern art is dog shit? Not a line I want to go down. I like very much Robert Pinsky's teasing and highly nuanced attempt in The Situation of Poetry to show that modernism functioned as a tradition for poets at the time of his writing in the mid-1970s. One of the traditional elements Pinsky identified was the dramatic coupling of unlike elements. Benjamin's profane illumination, if you like. Mind the genealogies of that would be very complex and would probably reach back to German idealism, you might say Aristotle as well. But let me end this paper with another possibility. I have in mind Ted Hughes's famous and resonant claim that the lines a poet comes up with in the act of composition constitute a combination or a resultant of all that he is, unimpeachable evidence of itself and indirectly of himself. And for the time of writing, he can do nothing but accept it. This is almost a recipe for a poetry that will be as unlike as people themselves are. Or is that just our own version of what constitutes unlikeness? I suspect so. I would further suggest that such a concept of unlikeness bears the stamp and perhaps even some of the technique of the psychoanalytic era inaugurated by Freud, with its aspirations towards an absolute difference in the presentiment of unconscious desire.